Welcome to the Latchkey Tales, Book 2, Crowley Golden and the Isis Heart, a tale of Egyptian revival, written and performed for podcast by MJ Hahn. Good evening. Welcome to episode 6, and thanks for tuning in. So, listeners, last time we were up in Ashbury Heights visiting the cottage, we met Crowley's grandfather, Theodorus, yet another odd branch on the Golden family tree. Tonight, our story picks up a few days later, where we find Crowley Golden being dropped off at his mom's place for his usual weekend stayover. Crowley's dad seemed rather preoccupied during the drive across the Golden Gate Bridge, and, of course, Crowley knows exactly why. It was all about the upcoming press conference at the Legion of Honor. But more on that later. As we fade in, we find Crowley on a dirt road, shielding his eyes against the blinding sunlight. Chapter 6, The Official Incident. Crowley watched the juggernaut silently glide away and disappear into the dense thicket of trees that clung to the little hillside. The heat of the day was already building under the blazing late morning sun, something which had caught Crowley off guard. Summer was currently in full effect in the little coastal town of Bolinas, something which Crowley might have forgotten, considering the number of consecutively cool and foggy days he had recently spent in the city. Yet, as soon as the juggernaut had crossed the north side of the Golden Gate Bridge, it was as if they had passed through some sort of veil, delivering them into the blinding sunlight outside of the foggy dome that persistently clung to the city. Crowley turned and trudged up the short path, following his mother towards the quaint farmhouse. He seemed to grind each footstep purposefully into the gravel as he walked. Despite Crowley's protests about wanting to stay in the city that weekend, his dad wouldn't hear any of it. Morty was far too occupied with a certain pending news conference to listen to any of his son's complaints. The department was finally going to make an official statement as to the strange goings-on on that fateful night at the Legion, and Detective Golden was more than a little anxious. When Crowley had reached the end of the path, he pulled out his shiny new smartphone, poked it aloft hopefully in several different directions, then scowled.
Damn! Stupid reception. You don't get any bars at all.
Sloane looked over her shoulder with a little smirk.
Hey, is that a new phone? What happened to that piece of crap your father gave you?
Oh, yeah, that vanished a while ago. I sort of lent it to Wilshire because she lost hers, and then she went and lost mine as well. Guess she does that sometimes. But it always means an upgrade. Like this new one. It's pretty cool. Here, check it out.
Well, you won't be able to text or use those app thingies out here. Sorry. I know it's teenage sacrilege, but you're going to have to rough it for a few days. You can use the landline inside if you have to.
Crowley rolled his eyes.
Woohoo! Landline. I think maybe I'll just write a letter. You got any stamps?
Oh, ha ha! Get your butt inside, I'll give you some stamps.
Crowley chuckled and followed Sloane through the front door. He was surprised at the progress his mom had made with the renovations since his last visit. The recently refinished hardwood floors gleamed, and the air still hung faintly with the odor of fresh paint. The furniture was all new and modern, and exhibited a certain coordination which Crowley thought a little uncharacteristic of his mother. But maybe that wasn't true anymore. The move outside of the city definitely seemed to be agreeing with Sloane. At least it hadn't hampered her creativity. Her ceramics had improved drastically, and had also increased significantly in scale. Several new sleek additions had been placed strategically around the room. They moved through to the kitchen, where a number of packing boxes crowded the large butcher block table. Crowley saw that they were all full of newly made coffee mugs. But far from the clumsy and wobbly variety that he had become accustomed to at their former cafe, these were actually good enough for someone to buy. Crowley picked one up with admiration.
Whoa, these look really cool. Something I wouldn't be embarrassed to be seen drinking out of. And you've done so much around here already. The place looks really great.
Sloane nodded, looking pleased but modest.
Yeah, things have been moving right along. The studio is finished out back and there's an artist co-op in town that's interested in selling my stuff. Yeah, it's all coming together. Of course, I have had a little help here and there.
Sloane paused awkwardly, as if she had something to add. then quickly changed the subject.
So, I take it that this, Wilshire-Sutton thing is still going on?
Crowley tensed automatically. Sloane and Grandpa Theo were on the same page when it came to Wilshire-Sutton.
Yeah, the Wilshire-Sutton thing is still going on.
Hey, I was just asking. Grandpa Theo said that Yuki O'Malley had dropped by the other day?
Sloane noted her son's slightly slack-jawed expression.
Oh, I guess he didn't mention that little detail.
Crowley tried to maintain his cool.
No. Oddly enough, he failed to mention that. Huh.
And he also mentioned something about you needing a tuxedo? You're going to a banquet?
Crowley nodded thickly, still clearly stunned about the news of Yuki's visit to the cottage.
Yeah, tux for the Sons of the City banquet, 2 weeks from now.
Well, I doubt we'll find anything around here that you'd want to be seen dead in. There is that mall over in Corte Madera, though. I bet we could find something over there that wouldn't be too hideous.
Before Crowley could offer a response, the kitchen phone started to ring. Sloane answered, and a wide smile suddenly spread across her face, followed by a tumult of unexpected giggling. With an arched eyebrow frozen in place, Crowley took the opportunity to hoist his backpack over his shoulder and bolt out of the kitchen, heading up the stairs towards his bedroom. Crowley was relieved to see that all the renovating hadn't touched his space. His room was still a mess, just as he'd left it. He flopped down on the bed and saw that the old motorcycle jacket that had belonged to Sloane was still hanging over the back of his desk chair. The sight of the painted flaming skulls reminded him of the time he had lent the jacket to Yuki on a stormy day underneath the cafe's awning. He remembered watching her walk back towards the cursed castle, the grinning skulls bobbing away as they disappeared into the sheets of rain. It seemed like ages ago, back when they had been best friends. And now...
What was she doing just showing up at the cottage like that?
Crowley rolled over on his side and grumbled. Somehow, with all the Wilshire stuff going on, Yuki had sort of slipped his mind. And then, as if on cue, the feelings of doubt began to stealthily creep in. Feelings that always seemed to arrive whenever he was away from Wilshire. On those days when she didn't return his phone calls or flake on plans that they had made, when he was out of her general vicinity, he was always able to think a little more clearly. It was during these times that he saw Wilshire in another light, when she just came off as a garden variety manipulator. A perfect example was the recent occasion when he had dropped everything and met Wilshire at their usual rendezvous downtown. Crowley had braved the long lines at the Union Square Starbucks to deliver the orange mocha non-fat frappuccino to Wilshire as requested. Then he had spent hours sitting in the guy chair outside of various changing rooms waiting for Wilshire to try on a seemingly endless array of evening gowns for the upcoming banquet. Wilshire chattered continuously about how excited she was while she changed her mind between dresses. When asked, Crowley did his best to offer up an opinion, not that Wilshire had really seemed interested to hear it. After picking their way through every department store in Union Square, they were riding the elevator up to Wilshire's favorite restaurant, the Cheesecake Factory. She had cried out suddenly and began frantically digging through her enormous Marc Jacobs shoulder bag. By the time the elevator doors opened out into the restaurant foyer, Wilshire was in a full-blown panic. The worst thing imaginable had happened. Wilshire had lost her cell phone again. To make a long story short, it took several Diet Cokes and an order of conciliatory deep-fried mac and cheese to calm the drama down. And Crowley had ended up saving the day by lending Wilshire his phone. Just until she could get a new one, of course. And it was then that Wilshire abruptly realized that she had someplace else to be. With a sort of shadow cast over her face, she excused herself from the table, mumbling something about talking to Crowley later. Then she instantly began texting as she walked away. Crowley watched her until she disappeared behind the elevator doors. He merely sat there, on his own and phoneless, just as the check arrived, dimly aware of what had transpired. It was only as Crowley finally walked outside into the fresh air, and Wilshire's spell on him had begun to fade, that he realized. Wilshire lost her phone a lot. He suddenly recalled that the first time had been just before Yuki's birthday back in March, when Yuki had come up to him in school and mentioned a war storming over at St. Ursula's, and how that was the day Wilshire Sutton had walked by and actually made eye contact with him. How the blood rushing in his ears had drowned out Yuki's words, and everything except for Wilshire's shiny hair was in a sort of blind spot. Wilshire had started talking to him often after that, and their very first conversation just happened to have been about her recently lost phone.
It occurred to Crowley that if in fact Yuki ever did want to talk to him, she wouldn't even have his number, since it had changed with every new phone Wilshire had given him. He could almost hear Grandpa Theo's voice screaming,
"You lunkhead! I told you that blonde was bad news!"
As if the past few days at the cottage hadn't been bad enough. Lately, life there had involved being under GT's rather persistent thumb. Crowley had been assigned a seemingly endless list of chores around the house, culminating in the monumental task of clearing out the old workshop. At least that hadn't been too bad, once he had the place swept out and all of Vernal's old journals filed away on the library shelves. Crowley had managed to tinker with the dragon flyer, on the pretext that it looked a little dusty sitting there in its glass case. Yet Crowley needn't have bothered with such an elaborate excuse, since GT had been acting too distracted to notice anyway. Crowley also wondered that GT had seemed a little too eager for him to commence his weekend away in Bolinas. GT had practically kicked him out of the house. That, coupled with all the secrecy around Yuki's recent visit, made Crowley wonder what exactly the old codger was up to. It was then that Crowley was suddenly aware of the delicate purr of his mother's voice screeching up the stairs. In an odd sort of way, Crowley found it reassuring.
"Hey, you up there! So, my friend Sheridan is gonna be here for dinner tonight. I think it's time you two finally meet. Hello?"
Crowley blew out his cheeks while he flopped back down on his pillow.
"Great! This ought to be interesting."
Meanwhile, back in the city, up on Knob Hill, behind the wheel of her pink 1956 Metropolitan, Mrs. Flack had pulled up in front of Bloom's Antiques. The sight of the plywood-covered shop windows still made her shudder. She honked the horn a few times, thinking it wasn't usual for Irving to be running late. And then her eyes drifted across the street, where the enormous mass of scaffolding that shrouded the new Curse Castle loomed. Merity sighed. The project that she had been so enthusiastic about initially had lately been subject to delay after delay, leaving her feeling drained and a little disheartened. Plus, she wasn't as young as she used to be. In fact, you could say that the past year had felt like 50, which wasn't too far off now that Merity Flack had taken to aging gracefully. Even though she did wear her 70 years well, sometimes she wished for a bunch of scaffolding to be put up around her like some sort of cocoon, only to emerge reborn and 20 years old again. She sighed, firmly dismissing the notion from her mind while she came back to reality. The first item on the day's agenda was escorting her best friend Irving to the pending press conference up at the Legion of Honor. Now that the police were finally making an official statement in regard to the mysterious break-in, naturally, Merity thought that since Irving was a victim of the night's bizarre events as well, why wouldn't he want to be there? Merity was just going to honk the horn again when the door to the antique shop opened and Mr. Bloom stepped out. While he crossed the short distance to the car door, Merity couldn't help thinking that Irving looked a little out of sorts. In fact, Mr. Bloom looked positively rumpled. Merity frowned at his crooked tie, wrinkled shirt, and unkempt white hair, details which were, shall we say, uncharacteristic for the usually well-turned-out Mr. Bloom. He opened Pinky's tiny door and stepped inside.
"Irving, honey, did you sleep in that shirt?"
"Hmm? What's that now?"
Merity lowered her sunglasses and gave Irving the once-over.
"Don't mind me saying so, but you're a mess, darling."
Irving attempted to smooth down his shirt front and moved his tie, so that now it was crooked in the other direction. Finally, he gave up with a little sigh.
Fuss. I'm sorry, kitten. I don't know what's wrong with me."
"I guess you have been a little out of it lately."
"Oh, honey. Ever since that interview with that reporter, I haven't had a good night's sleep since. I keep having the same crazy dream with this hideous drag queen. Eyes like a cobra, and a voice like a Belgian longshoreman. I wake up screaming with my sheets all twisted up in knots. Oh, kitten, you're right. I am a mess."
Merity couldn't help laughing out loud, and then proceeded to spend the next few blocks assuring Irving that she was most certainly laughing with him, and that despite whatever else was going on, his sense of humor was certainly intact. But the damage to his little shop had left Mr. Bloom out of sorts, and the detective that was supposed to be handling the case hadn't returned any of Irving's phone calls, which didn't sit well with Merity, because she had already had a memorable and rather surreal run-in with the detective in question.
"After everything that happened last year, I still can't believe they let that nitwit Detective Golden back on the force.
Mm-hmm. Well, he did seem a little preoccupied when I spoke to him about my shop. Must be all that Legion business, I guess.
Huh. I don't know why that would be. Joe says it's a dead-end case, officially an ongoing investigation. And from what Joe says, the statement they've got him making today is quite a piece of creative writing.
What, you mean instead of your Mr. Halliday's story about zombie skeletons under the golf course? He did hit his head pretty hard, didn't he, poor thing?
Once the topic of marauding skeletons had been brought up, Merity stopped her grumbling and concentrated on driving. Joe's story about the skeletons had bothered her, and especially the vehemence with which she defended it. Granted, Merity's experience with the, shall we say, unusual, was considerably more than your average San Franciscan. Joe Halliday's as well, since they had both spent so many years in a certain corner of the city where the usual rules didn't apply. But somehow, Merity had thought that all that had gone up in smoke along with the Curse Castle. But what had happened to Joe and Irving clearly indicated otherwise. As they finally reached the top of 34th Avenue, a huge tangle of chaos in front of the stately museum greeted them. News vans and police cruisers were parked everywhere, surrounding the gang of reporters packed in front of the makeshift podium that had been set up. Merity maneuvered the Metropolitan discreetly next to one of the news vans that was parked just outside of the teeming throng of press cameras. They exited the little car and took in the sight.
My, oh my, would you look at all of this?
Merity took Irving's arm, and together they tried to wade through the crowd towards the podium, but the constant crush of people held them back. Then a murmur rose up in the crowd as several police officers in formal uniforms approached the podium. They were followed by Joe Halliday and a very stressed-out-looking Detective Golden.
Uh-oh, here comes the brass. And Detective Golden doesn't look very happy.
The police captain approached the large, tangled bouquet of microphones and began his speech. Merity strained her ears to hear.
I don't think we can get any closer. Can you hear what they're saying?
Irving shook his head while he struggled to listen.
First of all, let me emphasize that we are looking into every possible avenue to lay blame and bring those who are guilty to justice.
Irving scoffed.
That means they don't know what the hell they're doing. Surprise, surprise.
Merity nodded while the captain continued.
I'd like to dispel any rumors about this being some sort of terrorist attack, or that there was anything going on of an unexplainable nature. The press has been running wild with a story about exhumed graves from under the golf course. This is all based on unfounded hearsay. The fairway is having its sprinkler systems replaced at this time, which explains its current condition.
Here, Irving leaned in slyly and muttered under his breath.
Mm-hmm. You bet they need to replace those sprinklers after those zombie skeletons tore them up, right, kitten?
Merity nodded incredulously, noting that the crowd of reporters seemed satisfied with this official version of the incident.
I can't believe people are buying this.
Irving commiserated while the captain wrapped things up. Detective Golden merely stood there, looking haggard and dully nodding his head.
We would like to assure you all that we have several substantial leads, but due to the nature of this ongoing investigation, we are unable to comment further at this time. Thank you all for your patience in this matter.
The brass all turned in unison and exited from behind the podium. Joe Halliday turned as well, looking a little confused that he had never gotten to give his well-rehearsed statement. Detective Golden patted him gently on the shoulder with a little look of resignation while he escorted him away. The reporters began shouting questions, and the front of the museum was suddenly flooded with the flashing light from a wall of cameras that all ignited at once like a firing squad. It was then that Merity let out a sudden gasp of astonishment, thinking that she had recognized a distant face in the crowd.
What? What is it, kitten?
Merity motioned across the sea of heads to the place where she had spotted her.
Over there. Did you see her? The blonde with the dark glasses?
What now? Who? Which one?
Merity strained her eyes, but the blonde had disappeared into the crowd. She grumbled, and Irving gave her an inquisitive look.
What's all the fuss? Who was she?
Merity lowered her glasses, appearing genuinely concerned.
Just someone I haven't seen in a little while.
High above the sudden din of the clicking cameras, and quite unnoticed by the teeming multitudes, a bolt of purple light streaked across the sky and disappeared into the fog. It seemed that Mrs. Flack wasn't the only one who had seen Audra Lamballe in the crowd.
No way! Miss Disco Hippie Puke herself!
Tina Bleeberman charged through the blanket of fog, her tiara blazing like the head of a comet. Lamal's signal was coming in loud and clear from the black town car nonchalantly turning onto Gary Boulevard. It was just a few blocks away. Tina cracked her knuckles in anticipation as she soared over Clement Street. Just the idea of getting her hands around the bony neck of that old corpse sent Tina's mind afire with countless delightfully painful possibilities. A mere block later, she flew out over Gary Boulevard like a bird of prey. Well, a bird of prey that had failed to notice the bumper-to-bumper traffic below. Tina literally crashed into the wall of cell phone chatter that rose up from the street. It stopped her dead in her tracks like flypaper.
Ugh, crap! What the hell?
It took Tina a second to clear her head and maneuver herself away from the onslaught of irritating babble. But by the time the ringing in her ears had stopped, Lamal's signal had vanished. Tina punched the air, sending out indignant bursts of purple fire.
No way! This totally sucks. I can't believe I lost her.
It was then that things got significantly worse for Tina Bleeberman. While she hovered somewhere over 30th Avenue, she suddenly felt an odd pang coming from the general vicinity of what used to be her stomach. It reminded her of the same feeling she used to get after eating the 99-cent nachos from Pier 39. She waited a moment, thinking it had passed. And then it happened again. The same strange tugging at her essence. Tina held her ground with a fiery purple surge that sparked up every amethyst in her tiara. The odd sensation passed, and Tina grinned with assured victory. Then it happened again, and Tina's grin vanished. The same strange pulling, only 10 times worse. The painful twisting and tugging at her insides, almost like something was trying to turn her inside out. When discomfort had finally become flat-out pain, Tina realized that the pulling sensation had spread to every particle in her being. She seethed, and the stinging agony blazed accordingly. It seemed that the more she resisted, the worse it got. Finally, unable to stand the pain any longer, Tina let go. The pain ceased immediately, and Tina felt herself begin to disassemble. It was then that it dawned on her. Tina was being summoned.
You've gotta be kidding me.
The very notion, of course, went against every fiber in Tina's being. But clearly, stronger forces were at work here than Tina had been used to. This wasn't like one of Crowley's polite mumbled requests that had previously called her back from the hereafter. No, this time there was a definite tinge of command that really rubbed Tina the wrong way. And what was worse, there seemed to be no point in putting up a fight now anyway. The insistent tugging was too strong to resist.
Okay, you want me this bad? You got me, but this better be good.
Tina finally winked out and allowed herself to be delivered to wherever the pull so urgently led her. And so, Chapter 6 comes to a close. Special thanks go to guest voices on this episode, Jennifer Viale as Mrs. Flack, and Lisa Snare as Tina. Music on the program provided by freesound.org and incomptech.com. For more information, please check out the Latchkey Tales fan page on Facebook. Please stay tuned for Chapter 7. And until then, this is MJ Hahn saying goodbye for now, and thanks for listening.